Hello there. Today is Monday, January 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the record-breaking partial U.S. government shutdown continues as workers struggle to pay their bills.
I've pawned everything that I can imagine, and now I'm just at my wit's end.
President Trump and North Korea's leader set a date for a second summit.
We've picked a country, but we'll be announcing it in the future.
Also ahead, a former CIA technical operations officer who rescued six U.S. diplomats from Iran has died. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, as the partial U.S. government shutdown continues and hundreds of thousands of workers are now furloughed or working without pay, the impact is reaching people across the nation. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
What do we want?
Federal workers across the country say they've had enough.
What do we want? Pay! When do we want it?
Now!
Some families who say they've never had to depend on donations are turning to food banks for help. Even students who rely on free or reduced-fee meals at school are impacted. One North Carolina school announcing lunch menus are being revised to conserve food and funding. The Lambert family are worried about feeding their 5- and 6-year-olds.
The sooner they can do something about it, the better it'll be for us low-income families.
In California, TSA union leaders say this shutdown has gone way too long. In Washington, families letting Congress know it's time to reconcile their differences.
I've pawned everything that I can imagine, and now I'm just at my wit's end.
As the shutdown drags on, some businesses are also taking a hit. Mohamed Bada has been operating his falafel food truck in the District of Columbia since 2014. He says the ongoing shutdown has drastically cut down his sales.
Usually I do in this area, I do like 60, 70 customers. So far, maybe I did like 19 customers today. Especially this week, it's really, really, really bad.
Bada, who owns two food trucks, can now afford to run only one. He says if sales don't pick up soon, he won't be back next week and will look for another job instead. Meanwhile, there's no budging on either Democratic or Republican side. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Top U.S. senators questioning the Afghan pullout numbers. Greece's rally over Macedonia name deal turns violent. An Al-Qaeda group claims responsibility for an ambush of peacekeepers in Mali. And the death toll reaches 79 in Mexico in a fuel pipeline fire. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Well, today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the United States. It's a day officially set aside to honor the late civil rights leader for his role in ending legal racial segregation in America. Here he is at his last speech on April 3rd, 1968 at the Mason Temple Church in Memphis, Tennessee. It would be his last speech.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. A Arkansas justice, I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around. We aren't going to let any injunction turn us around.
King was assassinated the very next day after that speech. And while he was a civil rights leader, King was far more than that. He was also far more than an activist. He was also a Christian minister motivated by the moral teachings of Jesus and the Bible. But what many Americans don't know is that King's nonviolent tactics came from far off India, where the Hindu spiritual leader Mahatma Gandhi had recently led his country to independence from the British. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Professor Claiborne Carson, founding director of Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute.
Martin Luther King was influenced by Gandhi because as a person concerned about civil rights issues, he was looking for a strategy that would mobilize people into a source of power. And he understood the Christian message about love thy neighbor. And with Gandhi, he sensed that if he mobilized enough people around nonviolence, then that would be a source of political power. You could speak truth to power. After all, Gandhi in Martin Luther King's lifetime had mobilized the Indian nation to gain independence from the strongest power of that era. And Martin Luther King was the beneficiary of all of that. He absorbed that message.
And what is that message in a nutshell?
I think what it is in essence is oppressed people saying, we're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to try to meet force with force, but we can refuse to accept oppression. And we can do something that's going to disrupt that relationship. Whether that's a sit-in or a freedom ride or a demonstration, we will mobilize what Martin Luther King referred to as our soul force as a way of achieving our human rights.
It's always been striking to me how Gandhi and Martin Luther King fought for a universal peace and justice, but they both stood solidly within their own religious traditions.
Well, their message was rooted in their faith, but they were also critical of their faith. Gandhi was critical of the way what were called untouchables at that time were treated by people within the Hindu faith, the caste system, and he wanted to move beyond that aspect of religion. And Martin Luther King was also a critic, just like the Old Testament prophets were critics of Judaism. They were saying, you're not truly following the message of God. Both of them had the view that this was your obligation to try to use that faith and that commitment and that belief in a way that makes our society reflect the deeper values, egalitarian values of most religions, but recognizing that religion has also produced hierarchies of power. So you have to be critical of your own religious tradition in order to fight against that hierarchy within the religion. So they start as critics of their religious tradition, but they're also building on that religious tradition as a tool to change the world. And I think both of them succeeded in doing that.
I know King was often criticized and even ridiculed by some other civil rights leaders when he invoked Christ's words to turn the other cheek when your enemy strikes you.
But that's only part of the message. You know, the Good Samaritan story is another example of King taking a message that comes from the Bible and turning it into an actual political statement. What would it mean in today's world to help the wounded stranger along the side of the road? Treating that stranger as if that stranger were God, or treating other people as if they have the light of God in them. That is a very powerful message when it's applied to social issues such as poverty. Can you use that in the context of the Poor People's Campaign?
I know that for both men, the struggle for civil rights broadened into a call for human rights for everyone. For example, when King was assassinated in Memphis, he was there to support striking sanitation workers, not African Americans per se.
One of the things that was true about both of them is that they were involved in movements that could be described as movements for equal citizenship. For African Americans, it was getting rid of discrimination that was preventing us from becoming first-class citizens. It wasn't trying to change the rights of people outside the United States. For Gandhi, it was getting rid of colonial status and having a nation of your own. But both of them had ideals that went beyond that. What are the universal rights of people wherever they are, everybody in the world, regardless of their citizenship, but whether they have no citizenship, should have the right to pursue happiness. And every person has rights that are worthy of being respected.
Can you give me an example of this transition for each of the men?
When Gandhi was able to gain the independence of India, he became critical of the direction that India was going because he knew that citizenship was not going to free the people in the countryside of India. And in the same way, King, after the passage of civil rights legislation, he said that we need to move toward solving the problems of poverty, which is a global problem, and we need to end the scourge of war and violence, and we have to do it understanding that we can't solve them in one country without dealing with the same problem globally. Human rights is based on the notion that ultimately all of us are just human beings.
All right. Professor Claiborne Carson, founding director of Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. The third annual Women's March on Washington attracted a smaller turnout than the original event, which was held just one day after President Donald Trump's inauguration in 2017. But Saturday's event was no less rollicking as women and men marched through the nation's capital amid considerable controversy leading up to the rally. VOA's Anna Cook has details.
Donald Trump has got to go.
Braving winter winds and cold rain, thousands of men and women across the nation gathered in the streets of Washington to champion issues ranging from the partial government shutdown and the president's border wall to women's reproductive rights and gender equality. Mia Ives-Rubley, a transracial Korean-American woman who is disabled, has been involved in planning this year's march and says she is fighting to gain more rights for all of her identities.
My hope, you know, is to continue to talk about how these different identities interact, how we can support each other, and how it's so important that we are able to talk about disability, especially in the Asian American communities.
Compared to previous years, organizers say this year's march is different because they are pushing ahead with a solid agenda.
Really specific policy demands, and that's, of course, the women's agenda that we released yesterday. It was crafted by a policy table of about 50 to 70 women, movement experts, policy experts from really all backgrounds.
The recent dispute surrounding the leaders of the Women's March regarding allegations of anti-Semitism didn't prevent some women from turning out to support the demonstration.
I'm actually a Jewish Israeli, and I know that it's controversial for people like me to be here today because of all the controversy surrounding the Women's March. But I'm not giving up my seat at the table, and I'm here to make sure that anti-Semitism is something that is addressed and part of the Women's March agenda.
Even with a record amount of women elected into Congress, both men and women here say that there is still much more to be accomplished.
So I almost cried like when I heard that they all got like put in. I was just so happy, but like we still gotta make the moves. We have so many firsts now, and I'm just so happy about that. But like we still gotta bring the punches. We got some work left. Yeah.
Everybody supports women. It's not just the people being oppressed. It's all of us. This is one community, one voice. If you are going to trample on their rights, even though they're not me, that's still important to me.
In addition to Washington's rally, sister marches took place in multiple cities across the country, including New York and Los Angeles, and across the world. Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
All right. Well, the White House has announced that a second summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will be held at the end of February. The announcement was made after Trump met Friday with Kim Jong-chol, North Korea's top nuclear envoy, in the Oval Office, which the White House said was to discuss efforts to get Pyongyang to give up its nuclear program. Speaking to reporters at the White House, Trump said Saturday that he had an incredible meeting with the North Korean envoy.
We had a very good meeting yesterday with North Korea. That was an incredible meeting. It lasted almost 2 hours, and we've agreed to meet sometime, probably the end of February. We've picked a country, but we'll be announcing it in the future. Kim Jong-un is looking very forward to it, and so am I. We've made a lot of progress that has not been reported by the media, but we have made a lot of progress as far as denuclearization is concerned and We're talking about a lot of different things, but we've made tremendous progress that has not been reported, unfortunately, but it will be. Things are going very well with North Korea.
Well, Trump and the White House have given no details on the talks, and despite his upbeat comments, there has been no indication of any narrowing of differences over U.S. demands that North Korea abandon a nuclear weapons program that threatens the United States and Pyongyang's demands for lifting of punishing sanctions. Joining us to discuss is Lauren Richardson, Director of Studies, Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at the Australian National University. So given that the first meeting, while Trump touted progress after that, said North Korea is no longer a threat, we haven't really seen anything concrete. So why then do a second meeting?
A lot of analysts really criticized the first summit because, you know, there was so much fanfare, and in the end there were really very few concrete outcomes of the summit, especially on the denuclearization front. But from my perspective, I think that's all we could have expected when you consider North Korea has been building up this nuclear program for so many decades, and they've never had an actual summit with the U.S. I really don't think we could have hoped for much in the beginning, and I think it's sort of Trump's style to sell the summit as a major success because everyone in the world had its eyes on that. But I think what I was hoping for was exactly what's happening, that it would simply lead to further summits and that this denuclearization process could be negotiated over the long term. And I think that's the only way it could ever happen.
The U.S. president says there's a lot of progress that's been made with North Korea, that the two sides really have made a lot of progress on denuclearization. But again, short on details of what that sort of progress could possibly be. We know that one of the top officials from North Korea was just in Washington talking to the Trump administration about the situation. North Korea's definition of denuclearization could possibly be different than the U.S. or the rest of the world. Wouldn't you agree?
Trump's comment that there has been a lot of progress on denuclearization is an exaggeration. I think we've mostly only seen sort of symbolic gestures of, you know, possible intent in North Korea to pursue denuclearization, but not a lot of concrete action. Really, the two sides have been at an impasse over how denuclearization is going to happen. I think it's because Trump expects North Korea to denuclearize before he lifts any of the sanctions of North Korea. And from North Korea's perspective, it's been, we're not going to take any steps towards denuclearization to ease those sanctions. So I think the fact that this summit is going ahead probably is an indication that the U.S. has agreed that it will lift sanctions to some extent if North Korea is willing to take some steps on the denuclearization front. But I think that all we can really hope for as an outcome of this summit is more sort of disarmament of some of the existing missiles and vehicles that carry the nuclear weapons rather than actual denuclearization. I think that's still going to take several more meetings to discuss and resolve, and will happen over the long term.
And also, of course, there is verifying what they say, because we know they are not prone to necessarily being forthright and honest about their nuclear program. They promise things and don't keep those promises. And if they don't let UN inspectors in, how would this be verifiable? You know, if the U.S. lifted sanctions and didn't have any sort of verification that they were actually following through, I would think that would pose a problem.
Definitely the verification aspect of denuclearization is something that's extremely tricky. And I mean, some experts say it's never actually even possible to verify if a country is completely denuclearized. I think that what Trump will be pursuing some sort of concrete outcomes, you know, in the form of North Korea actually handing over its intercontinental ballistic missiles that are capable of hitting the United States. And that's why I think that'll probably be, you know, the most feasible outcome of this upcoming summit. And of course, the U.S.'s Japanese ally will also be pushing Trump to maybe also go for the medium and short range missiles as well, which are a threat to Japan and other states in the region.
There have been reports recently that North Korea's nuclear program is still an extraordinary threat.
That's why I really don't think there has been any progress. I mean, the main progress has been that we haven't seen North Korean tests missile or nuclear tests, which were very provocative and obviously made it look a lot more threatening, its program. But of course, you know, just in the absence of tests, you know, that program hasn't disappeared, so the threat still remains. I think what we've just seen is a de-escalation of the very severe tension between the U.S. and North Korea that was escalating in previous years.
What does it look like from the outside, say, where you are in Australia, that the U.S. president praises someone who's known as one of the worst dictators in the world?
It's something that's really surprising and I think hard to understand, and it's really, I guess, showing a divergence of interest between the U.S. and a lot of its allies, including Australia. I think it's something to do with Trump's negotiating style and his own psychology, but certainly there's not a lot of support for that approach. But at the same time, I think everyone is pleased that Trump has agreed to come to the negotiating table with North Korea once again, because North Korea's nuclear program does not only serve as a threat to the countries like U.S. and, and Japan that it often engages in belligerent rhetoric with, but also to Australia as a U.S. ally. You know, there was the question here of if the U.S. does get embroiled in some conflict with North Korea, will we have to then invoke our treaty and come to the U.S. in defense? At the same time, while we're not happy about Trump praising Kim and wouldn't necessarily agree with that, it's still a good thing that the U.S. is willing to kind of negotiate denuclearization.
All right, that's Lauren Richardson, Director of Studies, Asia Pacific College of Diplomacy at the Australian National University. Saturday, Sudan marked 1 month of youth-led protests against the government's economic and political policies. Human rights groups say dozens of people have died and the government has routinely responded with force to peaceful protesters. VOA's Salem Solomon spoke with Mo Ibrahim, a Sudanese-British billionaire and the founder of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, about what the unrest says about the state of the country and what might happen next.
So as you watch the unprecedented protests taking place in Sudan, what are your thoughts?
I think it's a total rejection of the rule of Bashir and his Islamist party in Sudan. After 30 years, people just got fed up. Their life is almost impossible. Failed policies, aggressive posture of the government. We had wars in the south. We declared jihad on our citizens and ended up splitting the country. They had the massacres in Darfur. And the economic side, I mean, the people are hungry. And they see the looting of the country resources by the ruling clique. Just people had enough.
Your foundation has called on the Sudanese government to respect the rights of civilians to peacefully assemble and protest, but it has also condemned the arrest of opposition figures and censorship of the press. What's your message to the government?
Really, enough is enough. And abuse of human rights will not just pass. I mean, they'll be held accountable. And if Bashir escaped the International Criminal Court for a number of years, he and his people will not escape justice forever.
What needs to happen next?
I think we need the international community to stand up and to show some moral backbone. Media in large has been quite silent about what's going on. All those people are being killed daily in Sudan. And the level of reporting is just incredibly low.
As you look at the democratic landscape of Africa, there are signs of difficulty in places like Sudan and Democratic Republic of Congo, but there are also positive signs in places including Ethiopia. How do you assess the state of democracy on the continent right now, and are things moving in the right direction?
We are 54 countries, and inevitably we have a handful of countries where we have difficulties. We have difficulties in Sudan. We have difficulty in South Sudan. We have difficulties in DRC. Although at least the fact that we managed to have an election there, that's a step forward. how credible that election is yet to be seen. But there's a lot of positive things happening in Angola, in Botswana, in Namibia, in Ghana, and yeah, I will hope in Nigeria, which will have elections soon. I hope we can also see a peaceful election. But I think the battle now is moving towards peaceful elections, more transparency. I'm optimistic, and I think we're moving forward. Unfortunately, not in my country.
All right. That was Sudanese-British billionaire Mo Ibrahim speaking with VOA's Salem Solomon. You're listening to International Edition. And as we continue, rising temperatures, changing rainfall, and encroaching diseases are threatening the world's coffee crops. A new study says many of the coffee's wild relatives, which could help the crop adapt to a warmer world, are also at risk. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
It's a really long way to go for coffee. But the coffee these scientists are looking for, you won't find at your local cafe. This is a rare wild relative that grows in the jungles of Sierra Leone. Coffee has 124 of these cousins across tropical Africa and Asia. But 60% of the family is at risk of extinction, says Aaron Davis, head of coffee research at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew.
So the main threat to the world's coffee species is deforestation. And that's because most coffee species actually occur in forests.
Those forest species may fight off diseases better than domesticated coffees, or they may do better in a drought, or they may tolerate higher temperatures better. Davis says those traits are increasingly important as the planet heats up.
The species we grow occur in very narrow climatic envelopes. That means that as the climate changes, as temperatures increase and rainfall decreases, the suitable area for growing those coffee diminishes.
That means trouble for coffee-producing countries, where the bean is a major source of income. An estimated 100 million small farmers worldwide grow coffee. Climate change threatens wild coffee, too. That's why Davis and his colleagues are searching the jungles for them now.
We don't want to be in the situation where we find ourselves requiring some wild plant or some wild genes, only to find that actually it's extinct in the wild.
Davis and colleagues say there's no time to waste. Their new study found nearly half of all coffee species are absent from the world's seed banks. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Actions of Iran have shocked the civilized world.
Let's go. Spread everything.
Our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages.
If we're going to go, then we need to go now.
A former CIA technical operations officer who rescued six U.S. diplomats from Iran in 1980 and was portrayed by Ben Affleck in the film Argo has died. A family statement and his literary agent confirming that Antonio Tony Mendez died Saturday at an assisted living center. He suffered from Parkinson's disease. Specializing in covert operations, Mendez helped devise the plan under which six diplomats who were in hiding were disguised as a Canadian film crew so they could board a flight and escape the country amid the Iran crisis. The daring plot captured the public's attention in the film Argo, which won the 2013 Oscar for Best Picture.
You have 72 hours to get them out.
You're getting a visitor.
Have you gotten people out this way before?
No. You're asking us to trust you with our lives. This is what I do, and I've never left anyone behind.
I know who they are, and they know they're hiding out.
It's over, Tommy.
If they stay here, they will be taken. Probably not alive.
We're responsible for these people. I'm responsible.
Believe your little story is going to make a difference when there's a gun to our heads.
I think my little story is the only thing between you and a gun to your head.
Tony Mendez was 78 years old. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter. and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News.